This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Daniel Estrin described the challenges of reporting from inside Syria, where today's ally is tomorrow's target, and where threats and allegiances this week shifted literally overnight. And we have heard a great deal about the courage of those whom the president sold out.
It's a group American leaders call the greatest warriors fighting the Islamic State.
20-year-old Eflin loads rounds into her heavy machine gun. She's part of an all-female Kurdish unit on the front lines in the war on ISIS here in northeastern Syria.
These Kurdish Peshmerga soldiers are on the offensive, fighting to stop ISIS militants from reaching a major battle just 35 miles from Baghdad.
In a dusty camp in Malikiya, Syria, Iraqi refugees have new heroes, Syrian Kurdish fighters who battled militants to carve out an escape route for tens of thousands trapped on a mountaintop.
But to view the story as simply the betrayal of our courageous super warrior allies is to miss a more existential drama now unfolding: the looming destruction of a fledgling society. Rojava is not just an enclave, it is a radical experiment in ecological, feminist, communitarian democracy. Rojava's three cantons in the north of Syria operate independently, but according to a shared social contract prescribing democratic processes within a highly socialistic framework. It's a place that, until recently at least, had a population nearing 2 million, mostly Kurdish, but with ethnic and religious diversity. And its political experiment was functioning fairly well, until the abrupt retreat of the United States from northern Syria. Jenna Krajewski is a journalist who has reported on Kurds throughout the region. She says that lost in the narrative of war is the story of a threatened oasis of democracy.
The way that they would describe it is democratic confederalism. And that comes from the writings of Abdullah Öcalan, who is the founder of the PKK. He's in prison. And he's in turn inspired by a whole variety of people, among them an American philosopher by the name of Murray Bookchin.
An attempt on a neighborhood basis, on a civic basis, where people can get together into assemblies on the basis of a number of broad social issues.
Whose ideas of democratic confederalism, a really decentralized government, inspired Öcalan in prison, who then wrote these texts that were taken to the Kurdish public in Turkey and elsewhere, who were inspired to found this government in Rojava based on those principles. And they're really outlined in quite some detail in the Social Contract, which is the name of the Rojava Constitution, focusing on decentralized power, on neighborhood councils that come up with their own rules, that make sure to represent the diversity of the neighborhood, of the area, in terms of religion, in terms of ethnic identity, all the way up to a kind of executive power and how much power they actually have, their term limits, who they're supposed to be. There's an equal representation of women and of men. There's quotas for religious and ethnic minorities within Rojava.
It's defiantly uncapitalistic in nature.
Absolutely. And in the social contract, they say any public resources, any natural resources, they belong to the people. It doesn't outlaw private ownership of things. It just says that we're no longer going to allow for these monopolies that we've seen happen in Syria and in Iraq. We're not going to allow for private companies to influence our politics. We're going to make sure that the wealth is in the hands of the people and for the people's benefit.
At the very core of all of this as well is the place of women in Rojavan society. They seem to be at the heart of governance.
Yes, very, very much so. And in fact, I would say that women and women's rights and women's involvement have been at the heart of the Öcalan-inspired Kurdish movements for decades within Turkey, within Syria, within Iraq, within Iran. And you see that laid out really explicitly in the social contract. There's a co-presidency of a man and a woman of each canton, and they have equal power. And that representation goes all the way through, you know, the local councils, the conferences that they organize, the people's assemblies, all these groups that make up the Rojava government make sure to explicitly outline that women are going to be an equal part of it. You see that also, of course, in the security forces, so the equivalent of the police, and in the military forces that were, up until recently, helping the U.S. fight ISIS. In 2015, I met a woman named Hedia Youssef, who was the co-president of the Jazeera Canton. And she, at the time, was working on a document that would, in even more detail, say how women are protected in Rojava. So she was talking about things like what happens if a woman gets pregnant and she's on the job, domestic violence, marital rape, polygamy, issues that are core to a woman actually feeling like they're participating in a society or government, but that are left out of the sort of more general social contract.
It wouldn't be shocking if the aspirations didn't quite meet the realities. How has the society embraced the social contract that does seem to conflict with traditional values and norms?
Well, I think at this point, we can actually say that there is a long tradition of feminism in the Kurdish movement in the region, because it was part of the foundational conversations that, you know, Öcalan and other founders had in the 70s when they were first establishing the PKK. You look at the major political parties, the major Kurdish political parties that have existed throughout the years, and there is the same idea of having women and men occupy one position. So Kurdish women have made tremendous strides in Turkey in terms of taking the ideas of the PKK and sort of the idea of the female fighter, which is where it started, and evolved that into political representation, into representation in civil society, into all those things.
You mentioned the women fighters, and it obviously got a lot of attention from the press.
On the front line between Kurdish fighters and Islamic State militants, a group of young women have mobilized. They've left their homes and dreams behind to fight on the front line.
The problem that I have with the way that the media focuses on the military side of things is that it so rarely pulls back and looks at what those women are really fighting for. Because they were fighting ISIS that day or that week, and they were allied with the U.S. because it was the best alliance in order to fight ISIS, but they were fighting for the things laid out in that social contract.
Let's talk about what the governance of Jazeera and the other two cantons looks like.
They describe it as communes. Each commune has its own council, and that council makes the decisions for that local commune. It also participates in electing officials that are higher up, so the co-presidents of certain cantons. The cantons themselves have autonomous governance, although they all are governed by the ideals of the social contract. So these local councils have been making decisions that are really practical to the situation that they're in and how local they are, about food, about security, about streetlights, about how to intervene if there's a domestic dispute, things like that. They're responsible for electing a judiciary that is also meant to represent the people.
And it's all kind of working, albeit at a small scale, in spite of the fact that it is a war-torn region with something a lot less than a robust economy. But there are aspects of the society that, you know, are kind of eyebrow-raising.
Right. I think it's very, very important not to romanticize the project. And there has been plenty to criticize. Among them, the use of soldiers under the age of 18, which the PYD, the political party in charge, they would deny or they would sort of hedge when you would ask that question. And yet when I was there, I went to a funeral for a 16-year-old soldier. And I asked his sister why he was fighting. And her answer was just, well, he was a patriot and we all fight in this family. So there was a feeling of just total devotion to the cause. And you could kind of feel that elsewhere. I had spent so much time in Turkey talking to Kurdish people about the PKK that I knew that there was ambivalence there, that it wasn't just a straightforward adoration of the PKK and of Öcalan, that it had become a complicated relationship, which is inevitable.
The whole idea that this experiment is taking place in Bashar al-Assad's Syria, and he, you know, somehow has left them be in the midst of this great civil war. Why has he suffered the indignity of having this Kurdish model society cheek by jowl with Damascus?
The general answer is that there was so much keeping him occupied in the rest of the country that was more valuable to him than northern Syria, which hadn't really been developed. One of the ways in which Assad and his father before him oppressed the Kurds was to not develop their land. So if there was oil, it wasn't really exploited, that kind of thing. So the idea was just, there's this crazy war going on. There are so many people fighting. Let's just leave this alone for a while.
For this moment, now Rojava is at least temporarily allies with Assad in the vacuum left by the withdrawal of American troops. You know, all of which makes me wonder, what in the world happens next?
I hate to say it, but it does seem like Erdogan has gotten what he wanted, which was essentially to destroy this experiment in northern Syria and to make sure that there was no hope of Kurdish autonomy on the border with Turkey. The best evidence of the positive side of what was going on in Rojava is the pictures and stories coming out of the region since Turkey started the incursion. Just the amount of civilian life lost, people fleeing their homes. It tells you that, if nothing else, the Kurdish government in Rojava was doing a good job of keeping people safe from ISIS, from Turkey, from Assad. That's a huge achievement, and it has just been totally obliterated.
I've described the Syrian Kurds as having been martyred. Considering the public sentiment, is it a chance that it will have been a repression too far?
I have never seen an outpouring of support in the U.S. for a Kurdish story. It's bipartisan. It seems to really have appealed to the American public at large. And I think that that is the result of Rojava kind of changing a lot of the larger conversation about who Kurds are. The YPG helped the Yazidis escape Mount Sinjar in 2014 when they were being attacked by ISIS. The YPG defended Kobani, the town on the border with Turkey, in this really beautiful, passionate, you know, determined way, so that the PKK or the YPG or whoever are no longer maybe seen just as terrorists, or we accept that characterization without thinking about it, and seen also as heroes. So, yes, what's going on in northern Syria now is desperate and bloody and horrible. But the ideas that were taking root there, that were growing, those aren't going anywhere.
Jenna, thank you.
Thank you.
Jenna Krajewski is a journalist with the Fuller Project for International Reporting. Raperine Abdelhamid Hazan is a 27-year-old dentist in Komishli, Rojava. She is also the co-president of her local health authority, an administrator who has thrived in the 7 years of the Rojava Project. She spoke to us Thursday from her clinic, filled with uncertainty about Rojava's destiny and filled also with resolve. Raperine, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Rojava was built based on a vision of the world as it could be. Would you please describe for me what the vision is?
We start to build a unique administration here, you know. It was built on the female power, on respecting the planet, on the democracy of all of people living together with love and respect for each other. Yeah, it was really unique experience.
I want to ask you about life and politics in Rojava, but first, the invasion. I can hear the automobile traffic outside of your clinic. Are people fleeing the town as the bombing approaches?
No, they are not fleeing the town. They don't want to go out from their cities. But everybody close their offices and go to home to stay with their families. But the children start to be afraid whenever they are hearing some bombing.
I want to go back to, in general, before Trump's decision. You are co-president of your local health authority. What does that mean? What is your role?
My work was to organize all the health area here, all the health centers, all the hospital, all the clinics was under our control. We were trying to give the best service for all people here, you know.
And would this have been possible before the great Rojava project?
It was very hard. You didn't have the opportunity to work in your own medical center, in your own city. It was very hard to get the job there. But now, after we built Rojava, it was possible for everyone to work in everywhere.
Everyone, male or female?
Yeah. In our health authority, we have to be co. So one is male and the other absolutely going to be female.
The structure demands equality.
Yeah, it's equality. Yeah.
Now, Rojava is 7 years in development. How different is Komishli today from what it was like 7 years ago?
Very, very different. Before that, there was a lot of fear because the people here, they didn't like each other. There was difference between Arabs and Kurds and other people. But now after Rojava building, all of them together, Kurds, Arabs, Syrians, they all work together. They all love each other. They live together as one family.
It's impossible to separate Rojava from the trajectory of the women's movement in the various Kurdish regions. What do your mother and grandmother think about Rojava?
My mother, she taught me to be like this. She was always telling me that I can do it, that these people need someone like us, like we are young people, we have activity, we have creativity to build this town again.
And the men, have they embraced women's empowerment and women's leadership? Are they confused? Are they angry? Are they delighted?
I won't tell you that 100% they are positive. No, there is still some people they are angry, but I could say that 80% they are with us. They support us, you know?
So I want to talk about the last 3 years. There has been this great experiment in democratic confederalism, in empowering women, and at the same time, constant fighting against ISIS, against Syrian forces. It's just hard for me to imagine what life has looked like for you over the past 3 years.
The past 3 years was very long, hard years, actually, because we were living in war, we were fighting with ISIS, and we trying to be normal, to live our life as normal as we can. But all the day we are seeing our people, our friends, our sisters, our brothers dying fighting ISIS, you know. They were fighting them, and we were here trying to build up the city. It has been very hard.
Let's talk about right this minute. We are speaking to you over Skype, so communication networks are still up to some extent. What is functioning and what are you living without?
For the last 10 days, we are living without a lot of things. First of them is internet. It's come for an hour and then it goes out for 3-4 hours. The most important problem is our people there in Serekaniye are dying right now and we don't have the way to get them. Our staff cannot go there right now. I would say about me, it's not very hard to live without a lot of things. It's going good, no problem. But there's a lot of people who have a lot of deficiency, like food and place to sleep and electricity, even water. They have a lot of deficiency.
Naparin, you're obviously an optimistic woman. And I must ask you, as you wake up every day, is it with any hope for any sort of democratic future? Is it just desperation? Is it plotting for survival? What is in your mind?
Actually, I wake up every day and I say, okay, this is a new day. I will fight until the night and I will come back to my home to sleep again and wake up again to fight again. All of us say the same. We are not leaving our places here, even if Turkish attack our homes and or our hopes and dreams. We are staying in our homes. We are staying in our land.
As the war creeps ever closer to you, what story do you wish were being told? What do you want the international community to hear?
Actually, I want him to open their eyes to what's happening here, because, you know, Turkish attack is very dangerous to us. All our children, our mothers and fathers are dying here, and nobody opened their eyes on what's going on there. I'm just telling them to give us help, to stand up with us as we stand up with them and we fight the ISIS.
I it's hard for me to imagine also what you must have thought when you heard that Trump had walked away.
Yeah, it was very hard. After everything we have done, after all of our people that we have given, now they leave us like we did nothing, like we are nothing here. You know, it was very hard for us.
Left you to die?
Yeah, they are left us to die. If you are not living here, you will never imagine what's happening here.
The experiment, if it is coming to an end, has it been for nothing?
I hope it's not. We will stay. We will fight. Now Turkey tried to destroy everything we have built for 7-8 years. They are trying to destroy everything because they hate us, you know. And we are on our road until the last point of blood in our soul, you know, because it's really worth it.
Raperin Abdelhamid Hassan lives in Rojava, where she is co-president of her local health authority.
Thank you. Thank you.
All the best to you, Raperin. Thank you so much.
All the best for you, too. Thank you.
After Thursday's announcement of a ceasefire, Kurdish commander Muslim Abdi gave a statement on local TV urging continued resistance. Meantime, as of Friday, reports from Rojava suggest that the Kurds remain under attack from hostile forces. Coming up, when the press's demand for a simple answer gets in the way of the truth. This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.